Hello, everyone. This is Arlo Devlin-Brown from Covington & Burling. I'm a white-collar and investigations partner in the New York City office of Covington & Burling. And I'm joined here today by my colleague, Amanda Kramer, another partner in the white-collar and investigations group in the New York City office, and also one of the co-chairs of the firm's coronavirus task force. Thank you for joining our financial services teleconference series, Taking Stock, the Financial Services and Regulatory Landscape Today. This is the ninth session in our weekly series, so welcome back to those of you who have joined before, and we'll be having additional presentations on this topic in the coming weeks. We're very excited to be able to offer this series to our friends and clients and hope that you find it informative and helpful. Before we continue, I just wanted to cover a few housekeeping matters. First of all, CLE. For those of you who are interested in CLE credit, today's program has been approved for 0.5 credits in both New York and California. Affirmation forms were linked in the reminder notice you received for today's call. And folks will need to record the affirmation code that we'll share towards the end of the call and return that form to our colleague, Elizabeth Christiani. Her information is on that form, and if you do that, she'll send you a certificate of attendance once she receives it. We'd also welcome any questions you may have during this program. If you're interested in asking a question, please send an email to our colleague, Al McManus, and I'll give you his email right now. We'll try to answer those questions if we can during this half-hour briefing call, but if we're unable to get to the question, we'll follow up afterwards on an individual basis after the presentation. So Al McManus's email is amcmanus@cov.com. That is amcmanus@cov.com. So today's subject matter is the white collar investigations and enforcement landscape in the COVID-19 era. And we're going to be talking today, Amanda and I, about investigations by the DOJ, SEC, and other enforcement authorities with topics that may be of particular interest to financial institutions. Before we get, though, to sort of specific areas where financial institutions may have a focus, I thought it would be useful to just spend a few minutes at the beginning of this discussion to talk about what we're seeing here at Covington in terms of how the U.S. Department of Justice, the SEC, and other enforcement authorities have been operating since about mid-March when widespread lockdowns and work-at-home scenarios hit the governmental agencies just as they did the private sector. Amanda, I'll turn this to you. I mean, what are you seeing? Are cases moving forward? Have the DOJ and other enforcement agencies been able to sort of make their investigations continue, even with all of the limitations they're facing in this environment?
Thanks, Arlo. We've definitely seen an uptick in activity after the first few weeks of the shelter-in-place orders as prosecutors and enforcement agencies both recognized that this would not be a limited pause that they could wait for the conclusion of to resume in-person investigations after they successfully transitioned to working remotely. So we've had an uptick in requests for remote proffers and witness interviews conducted on various video applications. We've seen the SEC begin taking testimony remotely. And throughout this period, document requests have continued apace and have been picking up in the past several weeks. In certain districts, prosecutors are being asked to report weekly on how they're moving their cases, notwithstanding that they're working remotely, which has resulted in more requests for documents and presentations from company counsel so that there is something to report. Grand jury subpoenas have also continued to issue as, again, after a lull, grand juries are sitting, although in some cases, partially remotely.
Thanks, Amanda. You know, my observations are largely the same based on matters I've been handling, as well as matters throughout our law firm. I think there was definitely sort of a pause in the second half of March and early April as enforcement authorities, probably like all of us, were trying to come to grips with, was this something they could just kind of wait out? But I think now, you know, increasingly and, you know, unfortunately, you know, there's a sense that this is the new normal, at least for the near to midterm, and the cases are moving forward despite all of the limitations. You pointed out, Amanda, the taking of remote testimony and witness interviews. I think we've been seeing that across the firm. And then another phenomenon that most of our audience, who I believe is in-house counsel at various financial institutions, is quite familiar with. You know, in any investigation, the SEC or DOJ or governmental entity, you know, has sort of two principal ways they can investigate a case. One is they can sort of go out and do things themselves, like take testimony or interview witnesses, or, you know, any number of things that are sort of work that has to come from the government authorities themselves. And then the other, you know, part of an investigation, when you are particularly investigating conduct occurring at a corporate environment and you have a corporate or financial institution client, is to sort of push the work to counsel for the company. So I think I, anyway, have been seeing in my practice a number of requests that are sort of easy lists for the SEC or DOJ attorneys, and sort of keep the cases moving, but don't require them to do too much, sort of asking for reviews and reports on various topics, asking for documents to be produced. And I've seen sort of some old cases that have been dormant for a while get dusted off with requests along those lines. But now let's shift to specifics of COVID-19 related enforcement activity. I mean, unsurprisingly, the DOJ has been focused on criminal investigations relating to the pandemic. I think you saw very early on that the DOJ executive staff acted to coordinate and centralize investigations of these cases and really make it a national priority. There was a memo by the Deputy Attorney General, Jeffrey Rosen, that came out on March 19th instructing each of the U.S. attorney's offices that are present in each judicial district in the U.S. and the various litigating components of the Department of Justice, which describe the procedures through which the COVID-19 related fraud investigations and complaints will be coordinated nationally, and appointed one or required U.S. attorney's offices to appoint a coronavirus coordinator in each of those offices to oversee those investigations and prosecutions and collaborate, you know, with their colleagues nationally. You've also seen, of course, the Attorney General on March 24th create a coronavirus task force focused on hoarding and price gouging that's headed by the District of New Jersey U.S. Attorney. Several of our clients have received letters from that task force requesting information to help the task force identify price gouging and hoarding. In terms of actual prosecutions relating to COVID-19, I mean, what I think you're seeing now is low-hanging fruit, you know, sort of out-and-out fraudsters who are taking advantage of this situation, much as they may take advantage of any sort of, you know, crisis, you know, natural or otherwise. The more sophisticated sort of investigations, those take a lot longer. You know, they will involve, you know, much more intense and long-term investigative techniques, document subpoenas. So I think much like in the financial crisis in 2008, there, you know, were some sort of out-and-out fraudsters who were charged with criminal conduct at the outset, but the sort of company investigations that followed, you know, went on for many years after, and, you know, as many people know, didn't in many cases result in charges. I now want to switch to one topic that I think we'll spend a good amount of time on, and that is of significant interest to financial institutions. Many of our clients have been watching this, and that relates to concerns about the CARES Act Paycheck Protection Program. I think most of you on the call are probably familiar with the program's background, so I don't really want to spend too much time on that. But just to cover a few basics that I think get to the heart of why this program creates concerns for financial institutions that are in the lending business. So the PPP, as it's referred to, created a category of forgivable Small Business Administration loans designed to encourage small businesses to keep workers on the payroll during the pandemic. Applicants for these loans are required to certify in good faith that, quote, the uncertainty of current economic conditions makes necessary the loan request to support the ongoing operations, end quote, of the borrower. The trouble with this provision comes down to the fact that the word necessary is not defined. And it's, of course, a bit of a term that can differ depending who's saying it and what their subjective views are as to what is necessary. And, you know, you've seen a lot of sort of press-driven concerns raised about this within the government and some flip-flopping back and forth. I mean, notably, as lenders started to process these applications on April 3rd and went through the initial allotment of funds by April 23rd, you started to see news articles that reported numerous public and in some cases, apparently well-funded companies receiving these loans. And the Treasury has indicated its displeasure with this and has put out FAQs and made statements on television and elsewhere sort of discouraging this and encouraging companies to pay these loans back and announcing there may be safe harbors for doing so. But it's still a very fraught, I think, situation. Treasury has said it's going to scrutinize loans over $2 million for proof of necessity. And on the other hand, sort of presume that loans below that amount were made in good faith in terms of necessity. So I think, you know, going forward, this is my view anyway, you're going to see investigations of borrowers, those that don't return the money, particularly if there continues to be adverse press. I think there's going to be pressure to investigate. And I think it's also important, and we've mentioned this on other calls that are not as focused on financial institutions, but it's important, I think, for everyone to know that just because Treasury may announce what they're going to consider likely proof of or presumption of good faith, or that they're not going to prosecute or go after people who pay the loans back, that's not going to bind the DOJ and others. It's not going to bind state AGs. So I think you could continue to see lots of risk. I mean, state AGs don't necessarily have an obvious jurisdictional hook here, but I think, you know, you're going to see a lot of investigations relating to borrowers who are perceived to have taken advantage of this. But I think what we really need to talk about is the risk to financial institutions that may be making these loans. And, you know, there's some comfort there, I think. I'll ask you, Amanda. I mean, Secretary Mnuchin has said that the certification issue was really one for the borrower and that banks were, quote, not required to do due diligence. Seems to be giving some sort of comforting signals there. What risk do you see, Amanda, for financial institutions that have been making and may continue to make these loans? And, you know, what, if anything, can they do to minimize what risks might exist?
Sure. So I think that it's true that the financial institutions are not required under the CARES Act to do their own due diligence, to look behind the certifications that the borrowers are making before issuing the loans. And that was by design, because one of the most important priorities when this program came out was getting the money out the door to the small businesses that needed it to maintain their employees. And so anything that delayed that process was sort of streamlined, if you will. But, you know, on April 30th, DOJ made an announcement of a preliminary inquiry into possible instances of fraud in the Paycheck Protection Program. And Assistant Attorney General Brian Benkowski announced that DOJ was reaching out to 15 to 20 of the largest lenders to gather information, gather records to aid DOJ's efforts to ferret out fraud by borrowers. However, that announcement included a bit of a warning to lenders. The Assistant Attorney General said that in addition to borrowers, banks and other lenders also may be subject to scrutiny regarding the manner in which they made PPP loans. So there's not a free pass for sure. And one thing that has been clear to date is that different investigative bodies, different agencies are not necessarily coordinating perfectly and are doing their own investigation. And so even though the lenders didn't have to do their own due diligence on the certifications in the borrower's application, that doesn't mean that the way that they made the loans. And one area of risk is whether the banks are responsible, even if they're not looking at the certifications and investigating the bases for them, where banks have affirmative information already on hand that contradicts the certifications made by borrowers, what will the government expect the banks to do in that instance? And a lot of financial institutions that are making the PPP loans already have robust compliance programs and have taken steps to refine those programs over many years, including to address some of the risks that were faced by mortgage lenders that became apparent in the wake of the financial crisis, including ensuring that the individuals who are involved in reviewing the loan applications are following a strong compliance program. But again, to try to get the money out the door and to make sure that the borrowers that needed the money quickly to keep their employees on the payroll were served, one of the things that happened here is that Treasury approved a number of lenders to issue these loans that were not previously SBA lenders. And so when you look at the lender count, it's pretty striking. There are 5,511 institutions that have been lenders under the PPP program as of May 23rd. 40 of those have more than $50 billion in assets. 93 are in the $10 to $50 billion range. And then you've got more than 5,300 lenders that are just smaller institutions with less than $10 billion in assets. And so while certainly the focus of enforcement authorities right now is on the borrowers, based on the striking amount of money that's gone out the door, which is more than $511 billion at this point, issued in, you know, more than 4 million loans, that focus won't always stay on the borrowers. And so the compliance programs that the financial institutions have will be very important in defending or responding to requests by DOJ and other enforcement authorities. And, you know, while at this stage, the investigations are focused on the borrowers, as I'm sure everyone on the call knows, you know, the records that are provided to DOJ or to the SBA OIG are not limited in use. So it's not the case that the government is going to be prevented from reviewing those records or looking at them in a bigger analysis of how the financial institutions gave out these loans. So all of those things pose some risk and really ask questions that we don't know the answers to yet, because at this point, almost all of the investigations that we've seen are focused on the borrowers.
Amanda, given these sort of unknown and to some degree unknowable risks, are there any suggestions or thoughts you have in terms of advice to financial institutions on things they can do to to minimize risks as they process these loans?
Sure. I mean, I think in some ways the normal procedures in processing loans should be followed. And, you know, there should not be any drop in following an institution's internal compliance policies because of the rush to get the money out the door. And so to the extent that there was, there should be sort of a doubling down now so that if an enforcement authority comes knocking and wants to know how the loans were given out, who was reviewing them, what the process was, what efforts there were to detect fraud and report suspicious activity, as is normally done, you want to have a good case to make supported by records. And so, you know, the applications began to be accepted on April 3rd. And it was just about 10 days later that $349 billion in loans had been applied for and approved. And that's just a shocking rate and requires a lot of speed. And at this point, if institutions have the breathing room, now that the money has been given out, to go back and look at anything that wasn't done, or just make sure that all the T's are crossed and the I's are dotted, that would be time well spent.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more, Amanda, because I do think, you know, the problem with DOJ and other enforcement investigations is they're often done with 2020 hindsight. So, you know, it's easy sitting here today, I think, for some people who are on the front lines to, you know, feel sort of the pace of an emergency, maybe feel from Treasury or other government officials that the most important thing is speed. But when DOJ looks back at something years later, they're not going to necessarily be in that mindset or feel bound by what may have really been pressure from other government entities to move quickly. So I think you have to be very careful. You have to document things. You have to, be careful what you're putting in emails and things. I mean, emails come back to bite. And so, you know, some business person emailing someone else, you know, that there's some hair on this loan, but we should try to get it out now because whatever, it's going to be looked at in the worst possible light. Amanda, I'm curious. Go ahead.
I was just going to add to that. On the question of necessity, I understand that a lot of borrowers went back to their financial institutions after the news started breaking that larger companies that technically met the requirements under the CARES Act with no definition being provided at the time for the word necessary, that a lot of borrowers went to their financial institutions and said, hey, we've applied for this loan, we've been approved, should we give it back now? And that communication and the record of those conversations should be considered, it should obviously be preserved. But to the extent you've got a borrower telling a loan officer, I don't need this money, but forgiveness and at worst 1% interest rate can't be beat, will almost certainly be relevant to an inquiry by the government on the issue of necessity, even if it doesn't lead to a prosecution. And any sort of lack of controls in that area will be highly relevant. And, you know, I just want to say that the application and approval process was one phase. And now we're getting to the point where some borrowers have had their money for about 6 weeks. And in another handful of weeks, they're going to be eligible to apply for forgiveness. And the SBA just issued an interim final rule laying out this process. And, you know, lenders should think carefully about what that forgiveness process will look like. They're still allowed to accept the certifications of borrowers, but to what extent does a lender already have information that may contradict a certification that the borrower has, and what will they do with it? And the SBA has made clear that if it is determined that a loan was made to an ineligible borrower, that the bank will lose its fees. And so both from an enforcement perspective and also a sort of prudential perspective, there is a lot of reason for lenders to stop now before the forgiveness process starts, take stock of what has been done, what procedures were in place, and consider what procedures they'll employ going forward.
We have probably 4 or 5 minutes of material left, but I do want to take this time to read out the CLE code. So get your pens or computers ready, and I'll read it a couple of times. Capitalization matters. So the code is as follows. 8X, little x, capital P, 6. So that is 8, lowercase x, capital P, 6. So, Amanda, we've talked about, risks for potential future enforcement. Have you seen, or have your colleagues at Covington seen indications of the DOJ getting involved in this area as of now?
So far, we've seen the focus on borrowers coming out of DOJ, and the general sense that lenders are partners and are, as the Treasury Secretary said, middlemen who are just providing information. So we have not seen to date a focus on the lenders. And that I think reflects a couple of things. One, there is still a lot of low-hanging fruit out there in terms of blatant fraud, people making up employees or businesses that don't exist. And also that just the number of loans relative to lenders is, exponential. And so there are many more borrowers to investigate than there are lenders. As the cases come to fruition against individuals, as happened to some extent with the financial crisis of 2008, if a pattern emerges, if there is, a particularly high volume of fraud conducted by borrowers of a certain financial institution, it's likely that that financial institution will be subject to some scrutiny for, how all of these ineligible borrowers were able to get loans. But so far to date, that's not what we've seen.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point, Amanda. And I think there is a warning there for financial institutions. I mean, there have been instances where Covington clients have received outreach from DOJ fraud, or in some cases subpoenas from DOJ fraud, relating to potential misuse of the PPP loans by borrowers. And the pitch in these cases is often, you're our partner financial institution. We appreciate your help. We're all in the good fight here against fraud, waste, and abuse. But as a lawyer who's represented banks on a number of money laundering investigations or AML investigations into the bank's policies, I mean, that is unfortunately often how those investigations start. There's an investigation of people who are banking who are, maybe under investigation for corruption or for failure to pay taxes, or for any number of things. And those investigations can morph from, you're great, you're our partner, give us these records, help us get the bad guys, to down the line, maybe it's some different prosecutors on the case, who knows, but like looking at the records and saying, huh, bank, there were some red flags here. Why didn't you look at this harder? Let's take a peek under the hood of your AML program. So I think there are risks there. Well, I know we're running out of time. There's some issues we did not have time to get to today, including insider trading issues that I think may arise out of the pandemic and may be of interest to financial institution clients in the investment space. I encourage anyone interested in that to reach out, and we can send some information on, and we're happy to talk about it further. But I'm also respectful of trying to keep these half-hour briefing calls to the half hour. So I think we're going to wrap it up here for today. I just will lead a few concluding remarks. This is the ninth, as I said at the beginning, ninth of our presentations in this teleconference series. We'll have a few more over the next several weeks. Next week, our colleague Dwight Smith will be giving a presentation on the federal response to the impact of COVID-19 on mortgage lending, including forbearance provisions in the CARES Act and the actions of the FHFA and the GSEs. You can find additional information about all this on our website, www.cov.com, and on our COVID-19 toolkit page. You'll see links to both those things in our meeting materials. But again, thank you all for joining us today. I hope some of this was helpful to you. And again, we want to get you the most helpful targeted info we can. So if you do have questions about particular areas, just reach out and we'll come back to you. Thanks again, and that will conclude today's call.